President Trump announced late last night that he will wait to deliver his State of the Union speech until after the federal government reopens. It was a concession to Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, who said she wouldn't let Trump address a joint session of Congress until the shutdown is over. Since she was elected Speaker on January 3rd, Pelosi has emerged as a formidable foil to the president.
Please don't characterize the strength that I bring to this meeting as the leader of the House Democrats.
That was Pelosi in the Oval Office last month warning the president during a meeting about immigration. But how does Nancy Pelosi compare to past speakers? For a look back at this important job, we're joined now by historian Nathan Connolly, co-host of the podcast Backstory. Nathan, hello.
Hey, hey.
And Ed Ayers. Ed, it's good to be speaking with you again, too.
Hey, thanks.
My pleasure. So, Speaker of the House, big job. Number two in line for the presidency. And Nancy Pelosi, household name today, John Boehner, Paul Ryan. But who was the first truly famous Speaker of the House?
Well, Henry Clay, who would have been, in fact, a bigger name than those folks in his time. And justly so, because he basically invented the speakership that we know now. He said, well, here's the thing. I'm going to give you these committees, and legislation will go to those committees, and they may never come out. I'm going to give the authority to those committees to determine what we ever talk about, and I will actually choose who's on those committees. And so he basically controlled, as a kind of the traffic cop, all the legislation that came before Congress in those early years. So he's Speaker three different times during, you know, the 18 teens and 20s when all this is up for grabs, and he basically grabs a whole lot of the power.
So it is a powerful position, and you'd think that being number two in line to the presidency, that it would be a launching pad to that job, but only one speaker has ever done that.
Yeah, and people might guess for a while that they'd like to have this at a cocktail party. I'll go ahead and tell them the answer so they can know. It's James K. Polk, which maybe is not the first name to leap to mind. But Polk comes in as Andrew Jackson's hitman, in a way. He basically comes in and makes sure that the Democrats, which is a new party, gets everything that they want. He silenced the opposition. And the big issue that he's dealing with is slavery. And he is the one who basically develops what people would have heard of as the gag rule that we still talk about today. He basically invented this to stop Congress from receiving massive petitions that were coming in against slavery all across the North. And so he stacks a committee with eight people of his own party and one sympathetic person to the other, and these petitions go in and never come back out.
Okay, so let's talk about some modern-day speakers. And to do that, we're going to have a little bit of a quiz. I don't mean to stress you out. I think you're going to do just fine.
We'll see.
Because we have some archival footage. So let's hear this first one.
In September of this year, I will have served as Speaker for 16 years. And I'll have to serve just a few months longer in order that I might have doubled the service of Henry Clay, who served as Speaker of the House longer than anyone up to my time. He served 8 1/3 years.
Okay, I'm going to give you a little hint. That was a 1960 interview with reporter Eddie Barker, and it was courtesy of the Briscoe Center for American History. Any takers on this one?
I'll see if I can take that one. I'm going to
we're elbowing each other here. We both know the answer to this one. Go ahead, Nathan.
I set it up for you.
Yeah, Sam Rayburn.
Good. Yep, that's it.
Yep.
Sam Rayburn.
Tell me about
from
him.
The great state of Texas. So Sam Rayburn is a very critical figure in shepherding the House through, you know, some extraordinary times in the 20th century. The Great Depression was just at the wane when he steps into the speakership in 1940, and America really was trying to figure out what its involvement would be in World War II. That was not yet decided in 1940. Now, what's critical about Rayburn is two things. One, he's coming into this period at a time when there's broad disenfranchisement of African Americans across the South. So what that means is he's running from a safe seat, but many of the committee chairs are also running from safe seats. That gives him the ability to be a very, you know, light touch Speaker of the House. He doesn't have to do a whole lot, but can instead let the committee chairs really dictate the agenda inside the House. And that makes him very popular and less fraught with the kinds of fissures that would have potentially essentially shortened his term. So the length of his time as Speaker is directly related to what the political scene is in the United States, particularly around voter disenfranchisement, even in Texas specifically, where they're running an all-white primary until the mid-1940s. So the mid-1940s is also, I think, a time when, you know, Rayburn is stepping into his role as a bridge builder. He actually is responsible for securing the vote, a one-vote margin that allowed the country to run the draft and gave us the military that we needed to effectively win World War II. And he's serving constantly as an intermediary between more conservative corners of the Congress and the New Deal coalition that is still holding together through the 40s.
Okay, that's Sam Rayburn. His legacy is enshrined. There's an important building on Capitol Hill named after him. Let's see if we can guess this next one.
And oftentimes, as I watched him give the State of the Union message, and he would thrill the nation because he could handle the media better than any man that we have ever had in the history of this government. But he was merely talking words like an actor that had prepared a script.
All right, any takers?
Merely talking words. It's a great line, though, isn't it?
So I hear a certain accent there that sounds like it's from Massachusetts.
Oh, I think you're close. Yes, yeah, very close. Tip O'Neill, 1980s.
Tip O'Neill.
Yep, it
absolutely.
Is, exactly.
Absolutely.
And he had a special relationship with Ronald Reagan, of course, a Republican, but Tip O'Neill was a Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, so Tip O'Neill actually succeeded John F. Kennedy's old seat in Massachusetts in the early 50s. And in some ways, you could kind of think of him as the last great northern liberal in terms of people who had political power in Washington. We know Dukakis, for instance, didn't succeed in trying to attain the White House. So, you know, Tip O'Neill was there as a kind of opposite of the Sunbelt politician and Ronald Reagan. The two of them certainly shared, you know, any number of barbs and traded barbs in public. But in private, the two men were, by many accounts, friends. They actually brokered a number of deals after hours. I mean, in some cases, one could think about the whole moment in Washington as one that was slightly less overtly personal in the attack. Although, of course, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan were not opposed to, you know, giving each other the business in public.
Hmm.
Now, one thing about Tip O'Neill as well is that he, in many ways, became a kind of celebrity in the speaker's position because there were ways in which television was itself, you know, crossing this divide between celebrities and the political class. Reagan, obviously, is the top of that. So, I mean, I actually remember as a kid growing up, you know, in the 80s watching TV and, you know, just having images in my mind of seeing Tip on television for any number of reasons. And so I think it's important to think about the speaker's position as a symbolic one. And to do that, you really do have to appreciate, you know, Tip O'Neill as one of the early faces on the new kind of political celebrity approach.
Okay, by the way, you're doing great here in this quiz. We got one left to go. This one,
right.
I'm going to just give you a hint right away. This is a conservative, a Republican.
Okay.
We're here because we are taking the first steps, and we're taking them in a contract with the American people.
A speech in 1994, that word contract was very important.
Well, if Nathan can track a Massachusetts accent and understand it, I can do the same thing with a Georgia accent. So I believe that would be Newt Gingrich.
Where does he rank?
Well, we're gonna remember him because he's one of the more recent ones, and he's still offering commentary right in the here and now. But I think, you know, there's also a way in which, you know, Gingrich's tenure was certainly even more polarizing than the Tip O'Neill, Ronald Reagan era. And of course, he tries to go toe to toe with the president and effectively loses around trying to basically keep the government open or failing to do so. So, you know, Gingrich has, you know, I think a history that is never really solid in terms of the great speakers in history.
He rose to power in the mid-90s, as I said, in that Republican wave. It ended 40 years of Democratic power in Congress. Ed, your thoughts on Newt Gingrich?
Well, you know, I think in some ways, as Nathan's suggesting, he became the most famous after the speakership. He's been able to use that for decades now to become a kind of pundit. So he's not actually in power very long like Rayburn or Clay, but he's able to parlay that into a kind of a media presence that its own kind of power.
I think I'd be remiss not to, you know, we've been talking about history, but not to talk about modern history and just wrap this up with Nancy Pelosi, a historic figure in her own right. How do you think history will view Nancy Pelosi?
I think there are two ways to view her contributions so far. I mean, obviously, with the Obama moment in the early 2000s. You know, Pelosi was in a very important position to basically, you know, shake the new Democratic Party up. But there are ways in which I think she tried to hold a somewhat, you know, conservative line, or at least a middle of the road tack as Democrats were concerned. Now, with the new crop of Democrats in the House, there are, you know, there's a sense at least that Pelosi's job is to basically shepherd this new group and bring the Democratic Party slightly to the left. I mean, her flank is now, you know, much more animated, much more active. And in some cases, it's going to be a test of her legacy to see how she's able to institutionalize some of the folks who are now trying to pull the Trump administration's agenda to a more leftward lean.
You know, and that's very interesting in terms of content. In terms of process, in some way, she's a throwback to these very first speakers that I was talking about. She knows how to use politics. And whereas Gingrich was more of a public-facing sort of media presence, Nancy Pelosi knows how to use the power of the speakership, or she's trying to use it, you know, with President Trump's State of the Union address and so forth. So it's interesting that she's sort of a more bare-knuckles politician than some of the people that we've had in more recent times.
Inspired by Henry Clay. That's Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly, historians and hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. It's always good to speak with you both.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks much.